Hey there, this is Seth Wars from Channel 9 coming to you from Building 42. I interrupted your yoga session, man. Yeah. What's going on there?
It's really uncool, man.
That was a difficult pose. I don't know how you can do that. That's awesome. Well, we're here to talk about an important topic that I've heard about a lot, but I feel a little fuzzy about it, so I'm hoping you can help me out. And the thing that I've heard a lot about is microservices. So can you help us sort of get a grip on how microservices sort of works, what it is, and why we should be thinking about it?
Sure. So I think to understand microservices, you got to look at the way that applications have been traditionally developed.
Okay.
And if you go back 15, 20 years, the type of applications people developed were essentially what we call today monoliths.
Okay.
And there's a good reason why they were developed that way. If you take a look back at how hardware and infrastructure was provisioned, there was a lengthy process typically. You go to your IT shop and you say, hey, I want a few servers to run my application, and a few weeks later or months later, depending on the case, those show up. They're configured, the network switches are all configured, the operating system's installed, and then you go deploy your application on top of that. Mm-hmm. And your application's running for a while, business requirements come and change, you go and update the application, and poof, in one big piece, and it was very convenient to just have the whole application, all its componentry, all together in one bundle that you would just go and plop down.
Right.
The speed of the rate of change back then wasn't driving a lot of need for separating those things out and being able to manage them independently, and the lack of agility on infrastructure meant that you were very rarely adding and removing servers and scaling things out. You were basically, it's kind of very static kind of environment.
And that's why the bank would mail you, like, your bank's going to be out of service between midnight and 1 a.m. on a Friday night. And that's why, so you're saying, let's see if I understand, you're saying that the old way of doing things, the monolith, was very dependent on the hardware you had.
That's correct.
So yeah, if you could, maybe you could diagram sort of how these things sort of used to work so I can remember, and then maybe we can use that diagram to sort of build the microservices way of thinking.
Sure. Like, if you remember that kind of application model that was common back then, it was typically three tiers. That's not working. Three tiers. So if we take the front ends, for example, you would say, hey, this is where I get my client requests come into my front ends. So all my front end apps here. Then I've got my middle tier, which is usually my business logic.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got my back end, which is my data tier. And that was typically SQL, right? And these tiers are talking like this. And the reason that these were split up and we still call these monoliths is that there's a whole lot of functionality in each of these tiers.
Right.
And they were updating relatively frequently. And they weren't very scalable. They scaled up and not out. And so when, for example, your business logic tier, some aspect of it started to consume, require more CPU usage under peak loads, for example,
right,
because the load here increased, you would say, you know what, I'm going to go create a bigger server. So you would go and get your IT staff to go deploy a bigger server for your business logic tier, and then you would shut this guy down and start it up over here. And there would be some downtime typically when
course.
You do that.
So the cloud has really changed this, right? Because,
yeah.
I mean, if I'm doing stuff the old school way, you could certainly put this up in the cloud, lift and shift.
Yeah.
But is that really the best way to do it?
Well, so that's where microservices come in, and the cloud has changed a lot. For one, if you take a look at the way that infrastructure is provisioned in the cloud, it's within seconds or minutes you can get your virtual machines up and running. Mm-hmm. And so this case of I need to get a newer virtual machine, that takes a few minutes when I need to scale out my front ends, and even in the monolithic case, a lot of times these were stateless, and so you could scale them out. So you could add more of these and then have a load balancer. In the cloud, that's a few minutes. It's not like weeks or months like it was in the IT case.
Uh-huh.
But even more than that, the demands on the applications have changed. So the speed that businesses have got to react to competition and customer demands and the business requirements changing means that this old style just doesn't work anymore. Updating all your business logic in one big glomp doesn't work. And I'll tell you one of the reasons, it's kind of a learning for anybody that goes through this cloud box product to cloud services kind of evolution runs into is in the box product world, which this is really part of, you would go and have all your developers contributing code, and then you would have integration, and then you would have tests, and then there'd be lots of problems and figuring out what was causing the problem.
Right.
You know, you go back and try to diagnose it, and then you have updates, and then there's more regressions. And so after some period of time, you finish your integration, and then you say, okay, blam, let's stick this in thing on here. That worked back then because the life cycles, you know, the release cycles were longer. But now when the release cycles have to be faster, that model just doesn't work because the integration time kills your agility.
Yeah, that's true.
And so what you need to do is say, if I want to move fast, I need to break this thing up so when I'm testing, I'm not doing this big integration, and when something fails, I know exactly what failed, and I can go and address just that. I don't have to go through a big, figure out what it is, and then have everybody go and package everything together and roll everything out again.
I think this is a really good segue. This is a really good moment to sort of segue into what microservices is then. If we take this diagram, how would we take this diagram and microservice it?
Yeah, so let me actually get an eraser from my other board over here. And now that front end, let's just take the front end here. This is the marker that. So the front end actually consists of a few different things. There's the, you know, the endpoint service. This might be your web service.
Sure.
And then there's something that is doing a cache over here. And there's something that is doing optimization, business
sure.
logic optimization on the front end. In any case, there's a bunch of different subcomponents in
sure.
there. And it depends on the application what those will be. What you'll do is instead of saying all these things are going to go together in one big unit that I've got to do integration testing with, I break them out.
Okay.
And that's where microservices come into play.
I see.
Is I've broken up this monolith into its discrete components that each have a single purpose function.
Okay. So just a question, because it looks like you broke them into functional units, but it might be, could it be the case, because my challenge as a developer is to know how small to make these microservices.
Yeah.
Could it be the case that the endpoint might actually be two or three microservices with different varying degrees.
Yeah.
One's going to have the WCF call. One's going to have a new API RESTful thing. It might be tons of different things. Is that the case as well?
Yeah, it's absolutely the case. And I think this is one of the places where there's, you know, art and science of programming
sure.
is how small do you make these things? How single purpose do you make them? And that is kind of a judgment call based
sure.
on your agility and the team and how much investment you're going to make, because when you start to break these things up, there is some complexity that comes with that. And so
absolutely.
You don't want to blow it up to very fine-grained units when that's just going to ultimately slow you down. And so that there's no one-size answer for what is a microservice.
Got it.
But it's certainly not the monolith that all goes together.
I see. So to see if I understand, so then the business layer would be the same thing, right? There'd be another square
yeah, exactly.
with little tiny things,
Let's
and then the same thing with the data layer.
So this one has a bunch of different components in it as well. And then your backend, that is data, which even in a microservices world can be a separate service, like in infrastructure, in a cloud.
Got
a
it.
Lot of times this would be, you know, DB as a service.
Or something else.
Or
I mean,
something else, yeah, or blah object store, or NoSQL, right?
I see. And I think the interesting part for me as a developer is I can choose like my data microservices to be tailored to what it is. So for example, if we have a lot of customer data, it might be unstructured data, I store it in NoSQL.
Yeah.
If I have some accounting stuff, I need to store it in a database. And so that might be another service. And so it's kind of cool that you can actually choose sort of for your data infrastructure, how you want to do it and sort of separate it out.
Yeah.
That's actually really cool. So as a developer, you already answered this. You said that it's kind of a fine art to learn how to separate these things.
Yep.
But now that there's more of them, I feel like, wow, how do I manage this? I need to completely change my application. What are some tips that you have for, one, how to start to think about sort of breaking it up? And two, how do you actually manage this? Because
yeah.
like, are these all VMs? What's going
yeah,
on?
Yeah, great question. So as far as breaking it up, I would say, again, the art and science of single purpose component. Responsibility, ownership of data is really important.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to have this thing owns a piece of data that this also is interacting with.
Oh, I see.
Because then you've basically coupled these things together with some weird undefined kind of contract. And so part of microservices generally, the pure form is that you got microservice A and you got microservice B, and this one is providing some service to this guy. This has data, it's encapsulating some data back here, that the only way to get to it is through the API. And in microservices today, it's typically REST, REST API in the front. Well, it doesn't have to be, but that's generally what people
do. A really good smell then from what I'm hearing is that if you're doing something outside of a specific contract, you might be doing it wrong.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
That's where the complexity, the intertangling,
right.
the integration comes into play. When you have this well-defined contract, you can rev this thing as long as you preserve the contract in a backward compatible way or a way that allows this thing to update it at a separate time and not have to update at the same time, that's where you get your agility.
And to remind you of the second question, do these things all live in VMs? Am I gonna have 1,000 VMs running everywhere?
Yep, so actually, if we broke these things up and put them all in boxes that are as big as this original one, we don't need to do that, obviously, because they're all fitting together in the monolithic world in some size box. So that means that they can break out into smaller size boxes. And that's where virtualization really helps you, and containerization even goes a step further. So one of the things that you typically see with microservices is they don't stop just at breaking things down into virtual machines. Virtual machines are a great container for holding in code that is has a common operating system and needs to be strongly isolated from the infrastructure outside of it.
Okay.
But what you'll usually see in the microservices world is inside of a virtual machine, you allocate virtual machines, that'll be kind of the scale unit or servers, and then your microservices get deployed onto different virtual machines. So into usually containers, although they don't have to be.
Right.
You can choose to deploy your code as microservices and not have them encapsulated in any way. You can have your own package format for deploying them. You can not even resource govern them. You can do the old style thing. But the nice thing about using containers is that you get two things, especially Docker containers. You get image format, which has a nice ecosystem of images that include, you know, the common packages that you use in your runtime, you know, Java or .NET or whatever else you want to use, your application wants to leverage. That's up in the Docker hub or your own private repository. You put these images. And the other thing you get is resource isolation. And the reason that is good is you get a much more reliable experience, even than you got in the monolithic world. If this microservice is consuming a ton of CPU, you can cap it with this resource governance so it doesn't interfere with this other one.
Oh, I see. So it's like, it's now let's see if I understand the containerization. You're saying that containers are like mini VMs inside of VMs or less than that, more than that? How would you describe that?
They are essentially mini VMs. From the perspective of the code inside of a Docker container, it thinks it's the only thing running on the top of the operating system, when in fact, there's a shared operating system. So if you look inside the VM, here's the OS, and then here's container A, and then here's container B. And their view is they don't see each other.
I see.
Unless you want them to. But if you want them isolated, they don't see each other, and they can't interfere with each other from resource perspective. If you set caps, this thing uses X amount of RAM and Y amount of CPU. Now that's dedicated to this, and this can't go and steal it.
Got it.
And that means that if I deploy this container on my dev test box, on top of the same OS, typically this is OS with, I've got some projection of the operating system. This is Linux or Windows. And if it's Linux, I might have an Ubuntu projection here for this thing. I might have a Java runtime in there. And if these things are both using Ubuntu, they can share the Ubuntu image. So you get some other benefits too, because it's not like you're having to dedicate resources and images for each one of these. They can share where possible. But the isolation aspect of it means that I can go deploy this container on my dev test box on top of my Linux or Windows OS with its runtime dependencies in the container and with its resource governance. And when I test there and I think it works reliably, I can publish it up into production environment, and it will have the same resources and see the same environment that it's on my dev box.
That's interesting, because like the problem, for example, if you're building a Java app that talks to a Ruby endpoint, you might need a very specific version of Ruby and a very specific version of Java, and this other one uses a very specific version of Java. Traditionally, we'd have to make our own VMs for each one of them. Right. You're saying that with containers, we can put them all on the same machine and it works just
exactly,
fine.
Exactly, yeah. And if they're all using the same Java, then they're sharing the same Java image.
Oh, I did not know. That's awesome. Yeah. So this brings up another question, because I think now that I'm seeing this, microservices not only brings the complexity of multiple VMs, but it brings up the complexity of multiple containers inside of VMs. What if one of these things dies?
Yeah. What if
A is using its cap and B is not, but it's just sort of living there happily? How do you manage A, how many VMs we have?
Yep.
B, how many containers in each of those VMs do we have? And then how do you also manage sort of the fast deployment and scaling? It feels like it feels like whack-a-mole,
yeah,
right?
I've talked about like mechanics of how your app is decomposed. I haven't talked about how you orchestrate or manage the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little how that's done.
Okay.
And that's where this concept comes into play of a cluster manager.
Okay.
And so a cluster manager is something that's responsible for managing the microservices and the placement of the microservices across a pool of resources. And so if you give the cluster manager a pool of resources, let's just give it 4 servers or virtual machines.
Okay.
You say, cluster manager, this is your pool of resources.
That's your playground.
Yeah. And now what you do is you've got application foo, and it consists of microservice A, microservice B, and microservice C. And a microservices application platform will typically let you declare this. So you'll say, you'll have some manifest that says this has a microservice that consists of this image, these files, this configuration. Let's call that A. And I need to, for scale out, because that's what you would do to, instead of scaling up in the cloud, you scale out.
Sure.
I need 3 microservices. So this could be a piece of the front end. And this thing has different load requirements. And maybe for availability, I want more of them because it's a more critical piece of my app. I need 7 of those and I need 3 of those. Now what you do is the cluster manager has some API and you go and hand the application to it. The cluster manager at that point looks at this and figures out where to best place these things. So it might put an A here and an A here and an A here, and then B's in other places. It might even put B's
in the same place.
A cluster manager oftentimes will have the ability to load balance. So it will look at the overall load of resources on this and say, well, this one's getting hot or consuming some resources. I'm going to go move this container from here to here. It knows if there's specific requirements. Hey, this one, C, requires RAM. And RAM, there's not enough RAM on this box, so I'm going to put it over here by itself.
So it will shut it down and move it over?
What I was just talking about is the initial placement.
Okay, got it.
But what it could do, if it's really intelligent, so let's say that let's say that there was some other A's over here.
Okay.
And then C requires basically a full VM.
Yeah.
So it might say, well, you know what I can do? I can move A, I can shut that instance down and move it over to here. And that will give enough room for C over here. So that's an intelligent scheduler.
Right.
Cluster manager scheduler that will do that kind of thing.
And then it might even get to the case where it's like, I don't have enough, I need to add a new VM.
Yeah, that's exactly true. Like cool. If I said go at a C and there's not enough, one of the things you can do from the cluster manager perspective is have it be auto-scaled. Mm-hmm. So basically it could say, I need to scale out and create another VM. This is another awesome use of the cloud.
Sure.
Is that I can go, the cluster manager or some outside auto-scale thing can go and say, this is full, let's go and scale out to another VM. And then that would allow me to put another C in there.
Right. So when we're talking about these kind of distributed systems, because that's what it feels like, there's the CAP theorem, consistency, yeah, availability, and partition. How does it deal with partitions or issues like that? How does it know, for example, A struggling here, causing strain on these A's, making these B's not be as responsive?
Yeah.
How does it?
Well, so a cluster manager has a brain. Uh-huh. That is watching this whole thing. And that brain has to tolerate partitions. So a lot of times they use the Paxos algorithm to manage the state of the brain. They're keeping track of where these things all are, the load on these things, the placement constraints, this manifest so that it knows how to go rebuild this thing. And for most cases, like if you have a highly available cluster manager, you'll have at least 3 nodes, oftentimes 5, uh-huh, and the brain is on these 5 nodes and replicating its state across them.
I see.
And so if you have a failure of more than one, as long as you have 3 of them up, you can still, your cluster is still operational. You can still deploy stuff to it.
I see.
Things can move around. Once you drop below quorum, then the cluster stops and it's in an unhealthy state. So that, and in some cases, the brain is outside of this, uh-huh, where you run the app. So you'll have the brain over here. In some cases, the brain is actually running on these things in a distributed way too.
That's an interesting thing, because I remember from my operating systems class, that's literally what the scheduler is doing.
Yeah.
It's looking at all the processes and seeing, okay, you have CPU time. But this time, the CPU is instead multiple, not just cores, but it's multiple VMs with multiple containers, which seems to add the complexity.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be managing that.
Yeah, and exactly. You know, CPU schedulers on single box operating systems are looking just at CPU load. Huh. These schedulers, as part of the cluster manager, are called multi-dimensional schedulers, usually. They're looking at more than one thing. How much RAM is there? How much network bandwidth is on this? How much CPU do these things require? And it has to balance all these things. So it is a much more complicated problem.
So the other thing that I've looked at Hadoop. Hadoop was optimized for the rack, because now we need to get into like, okay, are these on the same network? And if there's a failure, is it smart enough to be on separate networks? Is it doing like the Hadoop thing?
Well, it actually depends on, you know, I've described the basics of a cluster manager. Now, there's various levels of capability that cluster managers will have.
I see.
And some of them understand this app model. Some of them don't and expect the app model to be orchestrated from outside.
I see.
And when it comes to what you've just talked about of configuring the network, of having these things find each other, because one of the things that you also have to do when you're writing these apps is A has to know where B is. Is it on this node or is it over here?
Yeah.
And so how does A discover where B is? Or if there's more than one B, or if B scaled up or down? And a lot of times that is handled with a naming service. It's called a naming service.
I see.
Which is part of the brain. Or in some cases, it's like bring your own naming service.
I see. So that's like a lookup.
That's like a registry. A yeah. It says A is on machine one. And
it's like your DNS.
Yeah, A1 is on B1. Yeah, exactly. It's a DNS. And in some cases, the naming service can be programming DNS. So you can have discovery through DNS. In other cases, it is a separate like registry with its own API that these things will go and say, hey, where's B2? I need to talk to it.
So this is pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah. And I haven't even covered all the things that the more sophisticated cluster managers can do for you.
I see. So it feels like we're getting to the point where it's like, okay, I feel you on how this works. Are there cluster managers out there already that we can look at just to even get started?
Yeah, there are. So one of them is Mesos. Mm-hmm. So Mesos is kind of this low-level, Mesos itself is the low-level cluster manager that takes individual containers basically and will place them. It does the resource scheduling.
I see.
It expects something else to bring an application model into play.
I see.
And you can write these things as application frameworks on Mesos. So Marathon DCOS is an example of one of these application frameworks that works on top of Mesos.
I got it. Okay.
And so that will, where's where you define this thing and your containers, and then Mesos' endpoint is right there. That's one example. Another one is Cloud Foundry. That's another one that has a cluster manager and has an application model associated with it and does placement and load balancing and failovers. Another one is Kubernetes, from which is part of the cloud native compute CNCF, Cloud Native Compute Foundation. And that is contributed by Google, and that is also one that brings its own application model.
Got it.
And then there's Swarm and DCO and Docker. So Docker is, of course, the container format we talked about. They also have a cluster manager called Swarm. The interesting thing about Swarm is that it is the Docker API on the front.
Oh, interesting.
So you talk to Swarm the same way you would to a Docker engine on a single node. And then if you have something
Compose
is like this, and you hand it to Docker Swarm, and then it will go and
poof
and put it out. Or you could give this Compose file to Docker on a single machine, and it will go and poof it up on that single machine.
I see.
And then, of course, there's our own Service Fabric, which is cluster manager with this and a bunch of capabilities for lifecycle management.
Well, so you're the CTO of Azure. Do all of these things work on Azure?
Yeah, actually, all of these work on Azure. We've worked with all of these companies to make sure that there's support on Azure. And in fact, Mesos is the foundation for our container service, the Azure Container Service.
That's amazing. So I feel like we need to do another video just on Service Fabric.
Yeah.
Because it's like we've been doing cloud stuff for a while. We probably learned some stuff during that time. And did that stuff go into the Service Fabric?
Yeah, so that's exactly why we've made Service Fabric available and why we're releasing it, is that about 10 years ago, we started on this journey of realizing Monolith just doesn't work for cloud and the agility that we need to develop services. And so Service Fabric became a cluster manager with a microservice application model. It went into production over 5 years ago, initially with Azure Database. So our Azure Database service is built on top of Service Fabric. It also powers Cortana and Intune and Event Hubs.
So there's some serious dog fooding going on.
And the core infrastructure services of Azure itself. So it's got a huge amount of production usage at massive scale. It's running on tens, thousands and thousands of virtual machines across Azure. So, and it's pretty mature. So yeah, it'd be great to go into more detail on that.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to cut it off here because I feel like we've sort of brain filled on this one. Yep. We'll have to get you again to talk about Service Fabric. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. We have learned about microservices from the CTO of Azure. Thanks so much for watching. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9, and we will see you next time. Take care.